Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and today I'm your host, Al Warren. Our guest is the prosecuting attorney of course, the Stephen Avery and Brandon Dassey case of Making a Murderer fame, and I'm glad you took the time to join me. So, Ken Kratz, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me this afternoon, Alan.
How do we begin? So much has happened. From an outside point of view looking in, I'm sort of surprised on the way things have happened for you. First of all, you wrote a book, and I've the first version, and I've listened to it all, and I think you did quite well with it, but you're causing a lot of problems with it. And you've got a new version coming out, and you've got a couple extra chapters, and I think that responds to the Making a Murderer 2. So why do you think there's such a backlash towards you?
That's a great question, Alan. From my perspective, it's just a matter of math. 40 million people watched Making a Murderer. At the time, it was the largest and most watched streaming entertainment event of all time. It's only been eclipsed, as I understand, by the Netflix show Bird Box since that. But up to that time, that's the most people that had ever watched something. Certainly, the filmmakers never expected that kind of a response. Netflix never expected that kind of a response. But when you have 40 million people being showed one side of a case, and not even the side, Alan, that was showed to the jury. In other words, Making a Murderer presented a alternate version of the evidence, an alternate version of the facts. I've been highly critical that the filmmakers omitted very important evidence that showed Stephen Avery was guilty of this crime. But when you have 40 million people being told that cops, as an example, planted evidence, or that there was a purple-topped tube of blood in the clerk's office, and having one of the lawyers recorded on the TV show saying, that's what proves that they took that blood and that they planted evidence, it's awfully hard to overcome that kind of narrative. The truth, of course, Alan, is the famous purple top tube that Attorney Jerry Buting refers to. Had a hole in the top of it, and of course you recall, I'm sure, if you, like everybody else, saw that as the smoking gun. That's the thing that proved, if you will, that the cops tampered with the vial of blood, and that the cops planted evidence, and went a long way towards Sergeant Colburn and Lieutenant Link being really, really pointedly criticized for not only the investigation, but the takeaway, the conclusion, was that they chose to set up an innocent man for murder and to go to prison. And the question I would ask, Alan, is what happens when it becomes proved that the purple top tube was not sketchy at all? What happens when Jerry Buting, as an example, got a written sworn statement from a nurse named Marlene Kranitz that said, I'm the one that put the hole in the purple top tube. That's how blood gets into a vacutainer, a purple top tube. That makes sense. And so when Jerry Buting got that written statement before the trial, Alan, he had that information before the trial. He knew that the tube wasn't tampered with. He knew that evidence and the blood that was inside of it was not used to plant any blood. In fact, we had disproved that at trial by the FBI when they proved that there was no preservative, what's called EDTA, in the blood stains inside the RAV4, yet the purple top tube was chock full of EDTA. So that scientifically proved that. But beyond that, the fact that the lawyers knew that the cops didn't plant any evidence, the fact that the filmmakers knew that these two honest, really impeccably seasoned officers with no history of any misconduct, with no history of any kind of discipline, you made 40 million people believe that they were crooks, that these guys were willing to frame an innocent man. The results, of course, that maybe your listeners don't even know, were that Sergeant Colburn was completely trashed by worldwide people. Every day he got death threats. Still does. Still does to this day. Every day he was called crooked. Every day his reputation was tarnished more and more and more, publicly and publicly. And even after Making Murderers release, even after people like Jerry Buting and Laura Riccardi and Moira DeRoz for the film, even though they knew it was a lie, they continued to perpetrate that myth. They continued to push their narrative that the cops planted evidence to get these guys convicted. Well, when it's proven beyond all doubt that that didn't happen, when it's proven beyond all doubt that these filmmakers lied, that they made up these things, that from a documentary, if they couldn't call it that, they do things like splicing testimony into court exchanges so that they can fool the audience into thinking something else was said. These are the kinds of editing techniques that up until 2015 would never have been sanctioned or never have been unscrutinized, I guess is the best term, by the documentary film industry or anybody else that cares about this kind of thing. But not only were these filmmakers not taken to task for that, Alan, not only were these filmmakers not criticized for what's been proven to be splicing or what's been proven to be presenting a false narrative, they were given four Emmy Awards for this. including one for editing. Well, when that happens and you're at the receiving end of this vitriol, when you're at the receiving end of these lies that that make the villains that were cast in Making a Murderer seem like crooks, when makes the prosecution and law enforcement seem like they targeted an innocent man, when 40 million people believe that's the case, and then you have the former prosecutor who by that time had already been resoundingly criticized, when he puts out a book and there's this concerted effort to give it one-star reviews on Amazon, and so nobody reads the book, but they pan it, they trash it, and all these misconceptions and mistruths are allowed to perpetuate.
It gets very
frustrating. And so when I present things like unedited clips, or when I present things like, well, here's what the jury got to see, I don't really want to try to convince anybody who's that entrenched in what they think, but I do want them to know that there's another side. There's a whole side that you haven't seen. In fact, perhaps importantly to some of your listeners, it was the version, it was the evidence that the jury got to see. It wasn't edited, it wasn't created for television. It was presented at trial, in both trials, which resulted in both of these guys being convicted for first-degree intentional homicide. So hopefully somebody in your audience will pause and say, well, that makes sense. If we were fooled, if 40 million people were fooled by these filmmakers, we probably want to be told that. It's okay that we're shown how we were fooled. But what happens, Alan, and you may know this, people get so defensive when they have already taken a position, when they've already very, very publicly announced that we support Stephen Avery, or we support the version that was presented to us in this 10-hour docuseries. It's hard thereafter to admit that, wait a second, we were fooled. We were told things that never happened. They led us down this path, and you know, you've got to raise your hand and say, look, I'm guilty. I thought Ken Kratz was a creeper or a jerk or a person who didn't have this kind of evidence or whatever they wanted to cast me as. But I guess more importantly, the two cops that were involved, when you come away thinking that they were crooked or sketchy or any of that kind of stuff, it was only because that's exactly what the filmmakers wanted you to see. These are people that have had very real impact by this TV show. It's ruined the lives of at least those two cops. Mine, I lost my law firm directly because of Making Murder. All these consequences on these people that were involved in the case 14 years ago that at the time was described as a highly competent and a very well litigated major case in the United States, but that script obviously has been flipped since 2015. My job hopefully is to put things out there that show there's another side. Everybody, please take a look at this other side before you jump to too many conclusions, and at the very least, give people a chance to make a decision for themselves what really happened.
Yeah, and that's sort of the reasoning behind me putting you on the show. Because first off, when I watched Making a Murderer, I came away with the feeling that you, as well as the cops that mm-hmm. they displayed, and Fassbender mm-hmm. and all that, were really kind of not very nice people, kind of
well,
evil.
Of course.
and kind of evil.
Hey, I'd hate me too if I believed what was on there.
Yeah, and I had that feeling. So, it's not unusual. But
okay.
And going through your book, first mm-hmm. of all, I've had 12 books published, so I know what a book is. And I listened to your book, and I kind of thought, well, it displayed a lot of evidence, quite honestly, that people need to look at. And it really disturbs me when I was looking at the reviews, and you have like hundreds of terrible reviews, and it's more about you in person than the actual book. So I don't know if they didn't read it or bought it just to slam you. I don't know.
No. There's all, hey, Alan, 79 of those one-star reviews came out before the book was even, you know, where they even could have read the book. So Amazon, by the way, we contacted them. They knew that they were fake reviews. Mm-hmm. But they said, you know, we don't take off, you know, fake reviews just because they're trying to impact sales, which as an aside, and we're not going to get political, but as an aside, you know, there's a woman named Hillary Clinton that wrote a book, and the Amazon, same thing happened to her. All the one-star reviews, check this for yourself, Alan. All the one-star reviews Amazon removed because they said, well, these can't be real because these people couldn't have read the book. Well, all of a sudden, I guess their position about cleaning up the fake reviews is applied to somebody like Mrs. Clinton, but when it's very clear, in fact, they admit it, they know that these are fake reviews to pan my book, they refuse to address that issue on their own site. And I think that's not surprising, but I think it's at least something your readers should know. The people that have read the book believe it's easy to read, it's well written, it's got a lot of pictures, it's got a lot of evidence, it's got a lot of things very clearly step by step to show you what the jury saw, and then I invite people to decide for themselves. In fact, you may recall in the first chapter, I say, don't believe a word I have to say.
Yeah.
This is all evidence that is there that I'm asking you to consider yourselves. And I still hope, and especially now, Alan, now that things have at least settled down and at least a little bit of people's common sense seems to have returned to them, hopefully it'll get a read. It's a cheaper book than the hardcover. It's really not something that if you spent that much time investigating and looking into this case, you know, why you wouldn't spend another couple of hours to go through this book that's got the other side is you know, it's a shame, at least in my perspective, but I'm biased because I know the whole story and I know what it is that Making a Murderer never showed these people.
So, well, it's a conspiracy-based country right now, and even politically as well as not. Doesn't matter what side you're on. So when you have that going on, how are you going to get people to go get over that hump? Because right now they think that you're in on it, and those detectives were in on it because they were trying to get out of the $40 million lawsuit or whatever that Avery had been put away, you know, wrongly for some of a crime. And so when you have that, automatically they're looking at you as you're the bad guy. You guys are the ones with the black hat.
Right.
In the cowboy. So what?
And
what,
so and you know. Yeah, and so let me just ask a couple of you know, obvious questions. Who made them think that? I mean, it wasn't at the time of the trial. At the time of the trial, these guys were guilty. All the people from Wisconsin who got to watch this case in real time, you know, it was on you know, wall to wall coverage on the 7-week trial. They could watch the whole thing, and Wisconsin residents were convinced after watching, you know, after seeing all the evidence, that the jury in both cases made the correct decision. Every court that's looked at the appeal, whether it's been a post-conviction circuit court review or appellate court review, whether it's state court or even federal court, every court at every stage has upheld these convictions. So you got to ask yourself, Alan, what don't we know? What haven't we been showed? Somebody thinks these guys are guilty, the jurors, the courts, the prosecution, everybody that sat through the trial. So what haven't we been shown? That's my point, Alan, is that if there's that many people contemporaneous to when it happened, in other words, at the time that this was presented, if it was almost universal belief that justice had been done, and then it was only this film, you know, more than 10 years after the fact that that threw shade on this particular case because of the agenda of the filmmakers, which is pretty clear. Isn't that something that that you want to look into some more? And I like I said, I hope listeners, at least to this show and others, will look at that. But you asked how I'm going to get over it. How am I going to get over the negative attachment, the ad hominem attacks on me? It's but Kratz, he did this, so we can't believe anything he says, despite it just being a presentation of the evidence as it happened. And it's not going to be from me, Alan. I can't repair my reputation. I can't tell people, but, you know, shake my fist at the sky and say, but you haven't read everything. You don't know this. That's not going to do me any good. It's going to take people like you. It's going to take people like your listeners. It's going to take a tipping point to occur where the Netflix viewers finally realize, hey, something screwy happened. Something terrible happened to these cops. They really were unfairly impacted. Their whole lives were unfairly impacted because of this. This shouldn't happen, and it'll get people to take a fresh look at it and look at the evidence, not through the eyes of, you know, we think Ken Kratz is horrible or deserves to, you know, be killed, which is most of the things that you see on the internet. But with fresh eyes that, you know, I'm willing to look at the evidence critical thinkers, and after that critical review, then they can decide for themselves. So hopefully others will change their minds. I'll tell you what, though, Alan, I'm up against it here. Nobody wants to believe they're fooled. Nobody wants to believe my side of the story. Everybody wants to think that this poor kid, Brendan Dassey, should get out. You know, he's got big hitters like Kim Kardashian and others who have publicly now come out supporting them. You know, I've got, eight followers on Twitter? It's an exaggeration. against Kardashian, 62 million. Well, you know, it's going to get drowned out, and you'll never even be heard. It's not even going to be a blip on the screen. So it's going to take somebody other than me, in fact a lot of somebody's other than me, to at least say, just take a look at the other side before you sign a petition, or just take a look at the other side before you get too excited about jumping on this bandwagon, because if you do that, then it's pretty clear that both of them were properly convicted.
Yeah, you know, I will say that too, because the backlash I'll get from this show is going to be incredible.
Good.
And there's people that
welcome to my word, Alan.
Well,
to my world.
being in the public like that, it's up and down like a toilet seat. I'll get slammed, and then I'll get, you know. So that's fine. And like I said, there's other hosts that wouldn't even jump in on the show. So there's people worried about their reputation. I'm not.
Yeah.
Do you think that the people that made the documentary had it in mind to do this? Like, what do you think they were doing by showing kind of side?
Sure. No, sure. When the filmmakers, when these two, they were film students at the time, when the two film students from Columbia University asked Dean Strang and Jerry Buting if they could join the team, if they could embed themselves with the defense team, be able to kind of shoot things in real time or strategy sessions or when they found things out, if they could report them. All of their objectivity was taken from them. They had no objectivity anymore. They became an investigative arm of the defense team. And I said before the case concluded, I said, you know, if you're going to be an investigative arm of the defense, then we're entitled to see your footage. We'd like to see what it is that you've been sharing with Mr. Strang and Mr. Buting from things that you've individually found out, the things that you haven't shared with the defense. As an example, It's well known that the two filmmakers knew of the existence of this vial of blood in the clerk of court's office into the summer of 2006, yet the state wasn't told about it by the defense, or certainly not ever by the filmmakers, until December of 06. Well, that's 5 months that they all knew about this vial of blood and didn't tell us. Why? Because they didn't want us to be able to test it. They didn't want us to be able to disprove that this was not the blood that was used. So Strang and Buting rolled the dice and hoped that that late disclosure of that evidence would make it impossible for us to send the evidence in and to have it tested in time. And they were almost right. But what most of your viewers don't know is that the FBI, in February of 2007, they closed their FBI lab. The FBI closed the lab for 3 weeks to handle one case. And the one case that the FBI handled was the Avery case. The FBI closed the lab to develop a protocol for the testing of EDTA, that's the preservative that's found in there. You may recall back to the O.J. Simpson case, that was the first time that this EDTA concept was brought up, and that if there was a planting defense, you could look at the blood. You could look at the blood that was actually recovered and said, does it have EDTA in it? It's a preservative that's in every purple top tube, so if you get blood from any of those tubes, you're going to find EDTA. And so when it's not there, it is a powerful piece of evidence because the protocol hadn't been developed correctly enough or carefully enough back during the O.J. case. The results were not allowed into evidence, and so it didn't work. But what happened in the interim, what happened between the O.J. case and the Avery case was that the crime lab in the FBI was developing a protocol. How do you test for EDTA? And so that entire three-week time period, there was a head of the lab at the time. His name was Mark LeBeau. He developed the protocol for testing EDTA, and the entire lab was dedicated to developing this test and then testing it. And in fact, they were able to find that this the blood that was recovered had no EDTA in it, and that the, as I said before, that the vial was chock full of it. So we were able to present that at trial. We got the results like 1 or 2 days before we were going to rest our case, and I presented that evidence very near the end of my case in chief, so that the jury got to hear that this planting nonsense never happened, that this was made up by the defense. And of course the jury heard that, and we blew the defense out of the water just with that evidence. But it goes well beyond that, that after the fact, the filmmakers, again knowing that was false information and presenting it anyway. You know, that's the kind of thing that, I don't know, if I was watching a docudrama and deciding, should I believe this? All of the places that they misrepresented, all the places that they spliced in words that were never there in real life, when they spliced in an answer, and that famous, don't you think it's suspicious when Andy Colburn is being questioned by Dean Strang about the license plates, and when the license plates are called in, and he said, well, you know, don't you think that looks suspicious? And Andy kind of reluctantly, you know, admits, yeah, it looks suspicious. And then the music comes in, well, you shouldn't have been looking at it. And Andy says, well, you know, I wasn't the things, and the big dramatic music. Well, what your viewers, I'm sure, don't know, Alan, is the answer, the yes answer, never happened in real life. In real life, I objected to the question. In real life, the court never allowed that question to be answered. But in Making a Murderer, you see him answering yes. You see him saying, yes, it was suspicious. Well, where does that come from, Alan? Where it comes from is it's harvested, the answer's harvested from another part of the interview or the interrogation in trial, and it's spliced in as if that was really his answer. Well, what the hell is that, Alan?
Yeah.
Who? What documentary, if you can call it that?
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
That gets away with that. What documentary splices in an answer that never happened in real life? And then when they're called on it, they say, oh, well, we never said it was true. We said that this was just for entertainment purposes. Well, my goodness, that certainly changes things, doesn't it?
Well, it sounds like Alex Jones. Not,
well, it's just, it's so deceptive.
Yeah.
And to not at least tell these people, this never happened, by the way, in real life. What we're showing you is made up for TV. What we're showing you, here's the sad part, is made up to make this man look sketchy. To make this cop, who's a good, honest cop, who couldn't lie about anything, we splice this in there to make him look guilty. And the impact that it has on him later, well, to hell with that. We don't care that forever he's going to be known as a crooked cop. We got good ratings. And because we spliced that and put that together, and it was very dramatic, we became the biggest viewed show of all time. Now, after the fact, after Netflix now knows that that's a lie, after Netflix knows that they spliced that in, how come that hasn't been changed, Alan? How come that hasn't been fixed? How come they haven't gone back and either taken this out of the documentary genre, or why haven't they issued a retraction or an apology, or what's happened as a result of their... not even carelessness, of their intentional misrepresentation. You know, I watched Game of Thrones, and there was a coffee cup or something that ends up in the shot. By the next time it was shown, Alan, it was fixed.
Yeah.
Well, Netflix has had four years. Why the hell isn't this fixed? You know that it's a lie. You keep perpetrating it. And when somebody like Andy Colburn sues you for defamation, when he says that you're intentionally making me look sketchy for your ratings and to my detriment, when he sues you, you've got you've got the guts to act surprised about that. You've got the guts to say, well, we can't be sued for defamation because we've got all kinds of protections. You may see that all the time with these big media companies not being able to be sued for defamation because they get to say whatever they want usually about people. It's got to change. Might have to change out there in L.A. Might have to change with the documentary film industry, who doesn't reward this kind of nonsense, who doesn't say, I understand you edited this beyond all recognition for what really happened. Let's not give them an Emmy for editing. How's that for a start? You know, that's just my personal opinion, of course, Alan. So hopefully this and other shows will at least start the conversation. Is there a line that needs to be drawn if you call it a documentary? How about the line is you don't get to splice things in to make it look like something happened that didn't really happen? That seems like an easy line to draw, and that's, I think, where we should start with the intentional misrepresentation to audiences. That's got to be curtailed, and I think it's got to be addressed, and this is the time for people to talk about that because it was as blatant as it could ever be right here, Alan.
Yeah. Now, one of the other big things that people complain about is the confession from Dassey. And a lot of people say he's intellectually disabled and he should never been in alone. And even if he didn't request or ask for someone else to be in the room with him and the cop, there should have been someone put in there by the police to make sure, you know, all this stuff. So you hear all of that kind of stuff going on.
Mom, Alan, was that?
No, that's true.
This is a serious question. Answer.
Yeah.
If his mom sat through that March 1st interview, let's say she sat through the entire interview, would that have alleviated the concerns of all the people who are clamoring that there should have been a lawyer or a parent present? Well, you'd think the answer would be yes, right? You'd think that would be good enough if that came. And so when Barb Yanda, the mom of Brendan Dassey, at Brendan's post-conviction hearing, was asked, well, weren't you invited to sit through every one of these interviews? And when Barb Yanda testified under oath, yes, I was asked to sit through them all by the cops. I was the one who rejected that. I was the one who said, interview him alone. I don't want to be in there while he's being interviewed. Well, isn't that what they wanted, to at least give the parent an option to sit through, which Barb Yanda was given? How many people know that, Alan? How many people know that Barb Yanda herself chose not to sit through those interviews? Of the six times he's interviewed, five of the times, I believe, a parent was requested to or invited to sit through. You know, one of the other times a lawyer was invited to sit through. And so the fact that that didn't happen, whether it's by his own lawyer or by his own parent, I'm not sure how the state of Wisconsin then is criticized for this kid making a statement. Here's the other important thing, though. On March 1st, Brendan Dassey was not a suspect. This was a witness interview, like any other child witness interview. And if you've ever seen them being conducted, the whole beginning of those kind of child witness interviews, when kids have seen something that is disturbing or traumatizing or hard to describe, certain things are said to kids to get them to talk. Okay, it's called rapport building, at least in the protocols for interviewing child witnesses. But in rapport building, here's the things you say to kids. You say to them, it's okay. We already know what happened. You say to kids in the rapport building start of a child interview, your mom encouraged you to be honest. We hope that you're going to be honest with us. I know what you're saying is, I know what you've seen is traumatic. I know what you've seen. You might have to use bad words or bad language. But we've heard it all before, Brendan, okay? So those are the kind of assurances that are made to him. At 11:45 in the morning, all right, about 45 minutes after the interview starts, Brendan makes his first admission. for the first time, Brendan moves from a witness, the traumatized witness, if not a victim himself of what happened, to a suspect. He places himself there when he admits that he raped Teresa Hawlock. Okay? So up until that time, these cops had no idea that Brendan Dassey himself was involved. How do we know that? Because I know, because I set up that interview, because I talked to the cops before that interview, because I told the cops, make sure you're in a soft room and that it's gentle and that it's recorded, because it's going to be a child witness interview that someday might have to be used. What he saw was probably horrific, whether it was on the fire or in the garage or anywhere else. And so the fact that that there's this perception out there that the cops wanted him to just say what they wanted to hear, well, that's foolish, because the cops had no idea what was going to come out of his mouth. The cops had no idea that he was involved. They had, you know, they were looking for what have you seen to implicate Stephen Avery. Tell us the truth about what you saw, and only the truth, because that's the only thing that's going to help us. Well, when he admitted that he himself was involved in the crime, what did you expect to have happened right then? Well, the cops then said, well, tell us all about that. The cops then changed. You'll see on, there's a new series of videos that I posted on the Brendan Dassey statements, on the March 1st statement. They're unedited. They're just out there for people to make up their own mind. But on the unedited versions, you will see the change in Agent Fassbender, as an example. When Brendan says, you know, here's what happened or here's what I saw. The next question, just like any other good interview, is an open-ended, well, tell me everything about that. Okay? Gives a follow-up inviting narrative. Well, tell us everything about that. And so Brendan does that, Alan. Brendan gives a narrative version about what happened, about the rape, about the murder, almost completely narrative in his own words, okay? Mm-hmm. So assume that that is in existence, and that's shown to the jury, and Brendan's jury convicts him because they see him in his own words telling what happened. Well, what happens, though, Alan, is nobody's ever shown that. Nobody's ever shown that part of his statement, that part of his admission. Well, you may say, well, the entire Brendan Dassey confession is on YouTube, let's say. It's on the Internet. You can find all 4 hours of his interview, and you can sit through 4 hours of his being questioned, and you can satisfy yourself, okay, now I've seen the whole confession. Here's the problem, Alan. Whoever put Brendan Dassey's confession on, a supporter of Brendan Dassey, I know who put it on, and had 500,000 people watch it. 500,000 people watched Brendan's complete interview and then sat back and said, now we're convinced that we saw the whole confession. Ken, you're wrong. He didn't admit being involved in rape or murder. How can you say that? And so my second video that I post, and that's on YouTube, that I would invite people to look at, is the YouTube Brendan Dassey confession. The YouTube version, the official version, if you will, go watch the whole thing they're invited to do. Have your viewers start looking at that video, and at 11:55 a.m., when his admissions, remember his free narrative, what he did, begin, until 12:24 p.m., all right, so 30,
it's not a math throw.
My math thing again. About 30 minutes of Brendan's confession is removed. It's completely edited out of the official version that 500,000 people watch online. So my second video shows you that, well, why would they remove all of his admissions? Who would remove all of Brendan Dassey's confession about the rape, the murder, the free narrative, that it's not in response to leading questions, that it's not fed to him, that it's a free narrative about what happened. Why wouldn't that be on the official confession? Well, the answer should be obvious, that somebody doesn't want you to see that Brendan actually confessed. And so they take this YouTube version, this YouTube, quote-unquote, full confession. Again, 500,000, don't believe me. Go look online. 500,000 people watch this. And a half hour where he says he did it has been removed. Well, if that doesn't make you angry, if that doesn't make you jump up for somebody who just wants to see the clips themselves and say, wait a second, you promised me that this was the full video, whoever you are that put this on here, and the place where he admits it, the place where he tells me he raped and murdered this one young woman, you've removed. And then you people have the guts to say to me, well, Ken, you're lying because it's clear that he never said those things. Well, it makes you want your head to explode. I mean, how do you combat that, Alan? How do you, with what I've told you about making a murderer, with what you now know about the supporters not wanting you to see exactly what he said, well, that at least has to make people pause and say, maybe there's more to this than Kathleen Zellner or the filmmakers or Jerry Buting or Laura Nyreiter or anybody else who's participated in this making a murderer gold mine, who's made these filmmakers millionaires, who's certainly advanced the careers of everybody else that's involved from the other side of this case. Everybody that lost the case has done very well, thank you, after they've been shown on these cases. The prosecution and the cops, however, the ones who were doing their job and simply presented the evidence, they've had their careers ended because of this. And if you can tell me that that's fair, Alan, we're all set to listen to you. Okay.
Well, I don't think it is. I personally don't. The other thing is, right now there's certainly a lot of people that want to have something to hate police for.
And that's
in the underlying part. One question I do have about it, but is that when the two, Avery and Dassey, were both tried separately and convicted separately. So now on both cases, there's a different storyline to how the murders happened. Like a lot of what Brendan Dassey said probably didn't happen. There was no DNA or anything found in the room where she was apparently tied to the bed and raped, and then they knifed her in the stomach and then dragged her.
So let me stop you.
Okay.
Alan.
Yeah.
Because I've got to unpack like four things. There's four things that you mentioned here, four complaints, and you got to kick them one at a time. Let's first talk about there's no Brendan DNA in the bedroom. Okay, that's one of the biggest complaints that you see online now is, well, nothing puts Brendan in that room until there's some physical DNA evidence. I'm not going to believe his confession, which I think is nonsense, because tell that to millions of rape victims that you needed some kind of physical evidence to prove that a rape happened. I want these Me Too supporters to go online and to say, we're not going to believe a rape happened unless there's physical DNA evidence that proves it. But I digress. So the question is, what DNA would you expect to find? What would you expect to find in that room from Brendan Dassey? Brendan Dassey was interviewed and asked if he knew what the term ejaculate meant. He did. And they asked him if he ejaculated during the rape. He said, no, I did not. So I got to ask you, what DNA would you expect to find there? What would you expect to find in that bedroom? Well, the fact is, you talk to any CSI person, you wouldn't expect to find any of Brendan's DNA there. And that's exactly what they found. None of his DNA there. So what does that mean? Well, not very much, because if you wouldn't expect it and you didn't find it, that isn't, you know, that isn't that big of a deal. But what they do try to then convince you is the fact that there is no, the absence of evidence, the fact that there is no DNA evidence that is found, means something. That the absence of evidence is just as strong as the presence of other evidence, which of course is not true. The absence of evidence doesn't mean anything. It means that they didn't find any there. It doesn't mean it's there or that it's not there. It's just that it didn't add to the add to the calculus. Okay, you understand it? So the that part of it you know isn't all that noteworthy. You know, your initial comment, there was a second part to it, a second complaint about the evidence and what people are concerned about. If you could repeat that, then I can address that.
What about Teresa Halbach? You know, why wouldn't her DNA be in there? Like, if they really had raped her and sliced her in the stomach, mm-hmm. and whatever, wouldn't there be a ton of blood and stuff from her?
So what? Right. So look at, you know, the only witness, if you will, that we have that is talking about what happened in that room is Brendan Dassey, right?
Right.
Stephen Avery is not telling you what happened.
Right.
Stephen Avery, by the way, cleaned that bedroom for 4 days before the cops got there. The day after Teresa Halbach is missing, and the day after Teresa Halbach, we learn now, is killed, Stephen Avery shampooing the carpets in his trailer. Now, you may not think that's a coincidence. You may not think that that is something that would raise an eyebrow or two, but when he talks to his girlfriend Jody on the phone that week, he talks about rug doctoring all the carpets and rugs in his trailer. And by the way, Stephen Avery's a filth. You know, he lives in filth and squalor. You've seen the photos of his garage. So the fact that he's scrubbing everything with bleach in his trailer, again, I don't mean to be, you know, suspicious, but it's something that you may want to look at. Yet nobody, that falls completely on deaf ears, Alan. Nobody says, well, I know he had 4 days to clean up. I know he admitted to shampooing the rugs. I know that he knows bleach kills DNA because he learned that his first time around. I know that they use a lot of bleach and paint thinner in the garage because it splashed up on Brendan's jeans, and we have the bleach stained jeans of Brendan that he turned over, saying these are the ones when we were cleaning things up that got splashed on me. By the way, who says that's not physical evidence? They talk about, is there any physical evidence that corroborates what Brendan said? Well, his bleach stained jeans seem to be physical evidence. How about the rivets from the Daisy Fuentes jeans that Teresa Halbach wore? And when Brendan Dassey said, after they carried her up to the garage, after they took her clothes off, they took all of those clothes and they put them on the fire, Brendan said. Brendan Dassey said, I put her clothes on the fire. So when they find the rivets to the jeans she was wearing that day, why isn't that physical evidence that corroborates it? Why is everybody screaming there's nothing that corroborates what Brendan says? When Brendan says that Uncle Steve went under the hood of the trunk and later, after Brendan says that, they swab the hood latch and they find Steven's DNA under the hood that isn't accessible from the outside of the car. Why isn't that shown in Making a Murderer? You know, why isn't Teresa's phone and camera and PDA that's burned up in Stephen Avery's own personal burn barrel, all those electronics of Teresa that are found in Stephen's own burn barrel, and he was witnessed burning the afternoon of the 31st, which you may think is a coincidence, But because that evidence was shown to the jury, and all of those electronics, her electronics, are there at his house, why doesn't Making Murder tell you that? Why doesn't Making Murder say, wait a second, there's no explanation for this. Steven can't explain it. This planting theory certainly can't explain all these burned electronics in this place that only Stephen Avery has access to. Yet everybody, as I mentioned, Alan, at least it's the impression I get, everybody wants to ignore that. Everybody wants this confirmation bias that they have once they decide what happened in the case. Anything that they can throw shade on the conviction and point to that they think doesn't have an answer, which I've now told you every one of these things has an answer to. But the things that do prove him guilty, why didn't they show those in Making a Murder? The answer is clear. It didn't fit their narrative. It didn't fit Stephen Avery. Poor Stephen Avery has been attacked again. Let me just, I shift topics, but these are such important, the narrative that poor people just don't do very well. Stephen Avery paid $240,000 to the two best lawyers in Wisconsin. You're going to tell me this was a poor person? You're going to tell me that the defense that they put on was something only poor people were able to afford? Are you kidding me? I've never heard of a lawyer other than this case making $240,000 for a murder case of somebody that's not a CEO or something. It's not Bobby Durst or something. So the point is the narrative that Stephen Avery is somehow poor or that he didn't have the representation. My goodness, that couldn't be any further from the truth. Yet people lap it up like it's being, fed to them like ice cream. So yeah. Those are some of my complaints, Alan. I know that we're running out of time here, and I appreciate you letting me kind of drone on and on. I hope that what I've shown is that my book coming out October 29th has a lot. In fact, has all of this information, including the two new chapters that attack the Kathleen Zellner allegations that she makes in Making Murder 2 and elsewhere. And I'd appreciate the opportunity. I mean, once this is released, or as that comes closer, as you get more feedback, to be invited back, and maybe we can follow up on some of this stuff.
For sure. And before we go, what do you think about the current inmate that's confessing to the murder?
Well, Kathleen Zellner put this fake offer out there, $100,000 for anybody who that leads to the conviction of the real killer. By the way, Alan, there's only one person that could collect that, and that was me. All right, yeah. I'm the one that presented the evidence that convicted the real killer. So, if she wants to write me a check, I'm certainly available for that. But that fake offer to invite, these kooks to come forward to try to collect this thing is exactly what happened. It's predictable that it's foreseeable that this is exactly what's going to happen. You get some murderer who clearly said, "I'm coming forward to collect this $100,000," and so whatever he says, in about 8 seconds, you can prove that he couldn't possibly have even been there that day. So that goes under the category of, you get what you ask for, Attorney Zellner, when you put something like this out there and ask for crazy people to come forward. Well, when crazy people do come forward, don't look surprised.
Well, you've said it. You've done it all. Now, do people get a hold of you? Like, how is it you want people to interact with you, and civilly, that is?
Well, I'm not sure I do. I mean, I don't mean to be rude about this, Alan, but I've put everything I have in my book, and I would ask that if they are willing to buy that, they can. I'm on Twitter, I guess, unfortunately, but it's a place that people can access me directly. I'm willing, if people are polite and they have a legitimate question, to answer them one-on-one. I've been doing that with dozens of people right now, and I'm happy to do that as long as you're polite and as long as you're not attacking myself or my family as part of your comments. The YouTube videos are available. I think the book, not only on Amazon, but it is available and will be available at most bookstores. And so if people want to find me and they legitimately have questions, I'm sure that can happen. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much. Ken Kratz has been our guest.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.